Blog Talk Radio.
I can cast a spell, see that you can tell.
And good morning. Welcome to Power Woman Magazine Radio Show. This is your host, Deb Bailey. I am so glad that you're here with us today. Y'all, it's storming here again, so hopefully we will have a great show. I'm really looking forward to today's show. We have a great author here today by the name of Jolene Filo, who sent us her book, A Different Dream for My Child. And let me just say, this book, it was just, I couldn't put it down. It was just so, it touched my heart, and I just love it, and I can't wait to share the book with you. Let's see if we can get Jolene on the line here this morning. Good morning, Jolene. Are you with us?
I am with you. Thank you. Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful. Welcome to Power Women Magazine Radio Show.
It is so nice to be here with you this morning.
Great. I'm telling you what, this little book that you sent us, it's so, I couldn't put it down. I think I read it in like 3 hours.
Wow, I'm glad to hear that. I get two responses on the book. Either it's I can't put it down, or if it's a parent of someone who had a critically or chronically ill child, they'll say, I can only read a couple at a time because it brings back too many memories. And then
aww,
I put it away and I bring it back out the next day.
Oh, yes. I just love it. It is so good. It's called A Different Dream for My Child, and would you like to go ahead and tell our listeners a little bit about the book and why you wrote the book?
Sure. It is a book of 60 meditations for parents of children who are critically or chronically ill, or for parents who have possibly lost a child. I wrote it because our own son was born 27 years ago with a birth defect that required immediate life-saving surgery, and then he had about 5 years of surgeries, a total of 7 surgeries with numerous complications and procedures throughout the whole time. Mm. And the big thing that made it extremely difficult for us was we lived in a very remote part of South Dakota at the time, and our son was flown 700 miles away from us, and we ended up being plunked down in a big city way far away from family, from friends, from any support system, and we just felt so utterly alone, and I've never forgotten that feeling. I've looked for years for a book that would help parents in that situation and didn't find any, and finally decided, well, maybe I was the person who should write the book.
Wonderful. Well, we're certainly glad that you did, because I'm going to tell you, I think this book will help so many people out there that are going through or maybe have been through the situation that you unfortunately have been through. And it makes them just feel like there's somebody that's sitting right beside them and hugging them and saying, you know what, it's going to be okay.
That's right. That's exactly what I was hoping for when I wrote the book. As I wrote it, I could just picture those parents sitting in hospital rooms or in a doctor's office being given a diagnosis or receiving a phone call that something had happened to their child. And I could just picture the book in their lap doing that, you know, being that you're going to be okay, you know, reach out to people. They're there to help you. It may not be a good situation. You maybe didn't wish for it, but things will, there is light at the end of the tunnel, basically.
Right. Right, exactly. And I'm telling you, I have talked to a couple churches in town, and I'm going to donate this book in your honor.
Oh, thank you.
To somebody that is going through this,
mm-hmm.
and the pastors will be contacting me back. And I thought, I cannot just put this on a shelf somewhere. This book is meant to be in somebody's hands that deserves
exactly.
it.
Exactly, yes.
So that's what we plan on doing with that.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome, more than welcome. The part I loved about it is it's little stories all combined together in the format. After you've shared a little story, then it has a prayer and it has a reflection attached to it. Now, was this your format idea?
No, that was the publisher who came up with the idea of that format. I had kind of just had the story idea, and my editor, Judith Markham, said, you know, if you could come up with the prayer and the little questions, that would be a great way for parents to reflect and have more takeaway value, I guess. You know, apply it to their own lives. Have it be
right.
more than just a story.
Right, exactly. And I think that was just an excellent, excellent idea because, you know, whether you're religious or not, I think that's beside the point. I think this is a book like a guide to help somebody through the steps. Because I know when you get in that panic mode, and not that I have been in your shoes by any means, but, you know, in some kind of mode with your child, you get in that, what do I do? Where do I go? What do I need to do kind of mood? And you forget. Sometimes to stop and breathe and say it's going to be okay and and collect yourself. And this book just it just keeps you right on the mark.
Right. And that was my hope. I kept the story short because I know that when you're in that situation, you don't have a very long attention span. And some days you don't have much time.
Right.
So I wanted just something that would be that little time to breathe and to reaffirm the truth that, you know, there are ways to get through this. There are things that can be done, you know, and if you are someone who's a believer that, you know, there's a God who is caring. And even if you aren't, I tried to write it in a way that was not preachy and tried to deal with universal truths that every parent and feelings that every parent has and needs to deal with in some way.
Right, right. And I think you accomplished that greatly because it has parts in there where if you are or parts that if you're not. And I think that's what really made this book so unique. And so where I've got to read and see what's next, you know, see what story that you have coming next. Which brings me to the unique question, where did you find the parents to help you tell the stories?
It was amazing. Most of them are people that I've known over the years. In fact, I used to kind of joke that I seem to collect families that have had illnesses or something that's happened to a child once our child had an illness. I was a teacher for 25 years, and some of the people in the book are either former students or families of former students that I've had. Some, one young lady, Jenny, in the book, who talks about being a survivor of leukemia, their parents or her parents were very good friends of ours when our son was going through his issues, and Jenny had her issues later after we had moved away. But I kept hearing about her as she grew up, and I knew she was someone I wanted to interview for the book. Several of the people were people that I taught school with, and we would just start having a conversation, and someone would say, "Did you know we lost a baby 30 years ago?" Or there were families where they had not only lost a child, but they'd also had a child with a severe birth defect. That was my reading associate. And then a few were people from our church that I knew and approached, and everyone was so willing to share their story. It was just amazing to go in. And I really didn't know their whole stories when I went in to interview them. And they just opened up their hearts and shared the deepest, innermost feelings that they had and experiences, and were so glad to do that because they want to help other parents who are going through it now.
Wonderful. Well, that is really gracious of them.
Yeah.
Because it just really moved the book along, and just it has some really great raw stories in it.
Yes.
That you could just
tell,
you know, what was going on and how they felt and the pain. I think three-fourths of the book I cried. There was a couple spots in there that made me laugh, you know, but you could just, it just really brought up that emotion that you just wanted to reach out and touch these people and just hug them and just, you know, I just love this book. It's just awesome.
Thank you. And then I should mention, too, I also interviewed two of the pediatric surgeons who had done surgery on our son. He had a number of surgeons, and these were the two that really stood out as being just not only skilled practitioners, but very compassionate, caring people with our son. And so I wanted to get their story because I wanted parents to know what it's like to be on the other side of the issue.
Right.
And then I also interviewed a pediatric oncologist, and they were all very gracious and just very eager to help parents in any way they could.
Right. And I think the way the story it intertwines with your own situation. I remember when I read it over the weekend that I remembered the part that stuck out in my mind was where you were in the scrub room and you were scrubbing to go visit him in the OR, I think it was, and you were sitting there and you couldn't believe they were making you scrub up to go in there, and then all of a sudden in a flash of an instant you thought, or your husband said, you need to get the germs off you so you can go in there and see him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought that was just ironic how you could just stop and say, you know what, this is what I need to do. And sometimes that transition is hard for people that have chronically
ill. It's very hard. And the hardest part is that when a child is in the hospital, you're not dealing with just one person if that child is going to get well. You have to deal with the parents also. They have to be emotionally and mentally stable so that they can support the child and they can make the right decisions to help the kids. And yet they're suffering greatly also. And
right.
So anything to help parents step back and see, okay, I need to be strong now. This isn't just about me. It's about my child. And then yet when it's okay for them to fall apart or ask for help, they need to realize that's okay too. That
right.
It's not wrong for them to have these feelings and it's not wrong for them to need support.
Right, right. So do you think it's normal, and I know a lot of people do this, that either blame God or the world once they receive the bad news about their child? Is that like an initial shock? People go through?
I think so. I mean, children are innocent. Why should they have to suffer? And so that's
right.
A question that we have to wrestle with. Why does this child have to suffer? Could there be a God, a loving God, who would allow a child to suffer like this? And you've got to work through that and come to some resolution. Or, I don't think you'll get stuck in anger and bitterness unless you take care of that. And then that will affect your child too.
Right, exactly. Can you share with our listeners some tips for first-time parents who maybe just received the bad news that is listening to this radio
sure.
show?
Sure. One tip is if you are the only parent, and I deal with some of these things also at my website, which is called differentdream.com, and I do deal with more issues for parents. So if there are any parents that have questions or things that I don't talk about today, they could go to differentdream.com and leave me a comment or a question they'd like me to deal with, and I will try to research and do a blog post about that in the future. But one thing I think is really important for parents, if you are the only parent, say you took your child to the hospital or to the doctor because something was wrong, and you received a bad diagnosis and they say your child has to go to the hospital right away, you need to call the other parent, or if you're a single parent, maybe you need to call grandparents or someone else to help you. I think it's really important for you and the doctor to stop for a minute and think, okay, let's not call the parent right away. Let's call, if the other parent is at work, call the boss and explain the situation to him, or call a friend or a neighbor. Have them go over and be there either while you call or break the news to that other parent so that they aren't just all alone and then jumping in the car and rushing off to wherever you are. And they're a menace to society and to themselves. You need to have something in place so that when that other parent receives the shock, they're supported also. You know, you're there with the doctor and nurses, so the other parent needs something too. And just take a second to just think, okay, how can we keep everybody safe? And then as quickly as you can, once the initial rush is over or the emergency is over, think of who and how you're going to start calling other people so that you get a support system going. You know, are you going to call extended family first? If you're involved in a church, call your church family. Call the pastor. Call the prayer chain. Call a neighbor. And don't feel – call your workplace. You know, if you're in a good workplace, call those people. They will want to help. Don't ever isolate yourself. You need to be reaching out, and you need to be telling people what you need and how you feel, because they're more than willing to come in and help you deal with that.
Right, exactly. And a lot of people, unfortunately, in that situation, wrestle with the guilt monster.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And why do you think that is?
I don't know. I just think we have this assumption that if we do everything right, everything will go right. And that's kind of the way our culture is, that if you just follow the rules, you will be rewarded. Well, life's not really like that. You can follow all the – and so if you do something if something bad happens to you, that must mean you did something wrong. But that's not true. Good things happen to bad things happen to good people, and it just happens. And in fact, I was just talking to another mom last night who was dealing with that. She has a son who's like 25 and has had cerebral palsy his whole life, and she said she wrestled with a whole lot of guilt of, you know, would he have been doing better if? And finally, she had to come to the point, and we did too, as our son grew older and started having some behavior problems that later turned out to be related to post-traumatic stress disorder, we had to realize that, no, we had done things right. And if we had not been his parents, things could have been a lot worse. You know, we always blame ourselves for what's wrong, but we don't know what we've prevented that could have been much worse. So I think guilt is just a normal thing, and it's really something you need to talk to someone about. You can't keep it inside.
Right, exactly, or it can get you all off course, and then you're no help to nobody.
Exactly, yeah, and it always goes back to the child. You know, how is this going to help my child get better? And
right.
if it's not, you need to readjust.
Right. I know in your book you talk about your arms aching, and I believe it was in the beginning kind of the book where after your son was taken off to a different place and you and your husband were driving to see him, after surgery, and you were talking about your arms aching, and your husband thought it meant something else. Can you tell us what you were talking about?
Well, it just I don't know if it's a hormonal thing after you have a baby, but you want to hold your baby, and my arms just ached. They felt so empty that they hurt. And I told my husband that as we're driving 700 miles away, and he actually started to drive faster then and tried to get to the hospital a little bit sooner. But I can't imagine how difficult that must be for parents who lose a baby, or either through miscarriage or stillbirth or a young infant, how much their arms must ache. My arms eventually were filled with my son, and it took a long time, but that hurt went away, but I know that for parents who have lost a child, that must be an extremely difficult thing to get over. And that was one of the hardest parts of the book for me to write, was the section on the death of children, which the publisher wanted me to address, because my child lived. And so I felt very much like a hypocrite writing about this. But again, families were very gracious and shared their stories with me about the loss of the child. And so I didn't try to put anything in my own words. I didn't try to deal with that. I just told their stories and what had helped them.
Wonderful. Can you tell the listeners what some steps of grief is?
And that is not one that I'm totally an expert on, but I know that at first you go through some denial. This can't be happening. You know, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and it's going to be okay. And when that passes, you will have a time of being angry. And one of the parents who shared his story does some grief counseling now, and he said the hardest part, and they were Christians, and he said the hardest part is that, and the ironic part is that what should be your greatest help, which is your faith, when you're angry with God, is your greatest stumbling block too. But eventually you get through that. And he was a very wise man. And his comment and several other parents were that it takes a long time. It's going to be a number of years. And I hesitate always to say that, because for parents starting out on that path, that's almost overwhelming to them. But they don't have to go through all those years at once. They just have to go through one day at a time. And he said it was very important not to rush the process, you know, not to try to get through all those emotions too quickly. But as he would put it, just let grief wrap its arms around you and embrace you. And slowly you will start to heal. You know, you'll find times that you can laugh again. But it does take a very long time.
I bet it sure does.
Mm-hmm.
In your book, you talk about how important it is for parents to see things as though their child sees it.
Yes.
Can you touch on that?
Well, this was first brought to my consciousness with a comment that my son made, And I think I was starting to write the book by then, but he and I was, or I was researching, and I asked him, is there anything you would want the medical community to know? And he said, well, they really, and of course he had surgery 27 years ago, so it's kind of, there's a whole new generation of hospital protocol since then. But he said the surgery he remembered the most was when he was 4, and he said, Mom, it is so scary. They put you on this gurney, and then they take you in this really cold room, and the lights are really bright, and it's all white, and then these people lean over you, and they don't have any faces because of their masks. And he said, you need to tell them that they either need to not wear the masks or they need to anesthetize the kids before they take them in the hospital, into the operating room, and anesthetize them while their parents are still around them. And that, in fact, is what most children's hospitals do now. They take the child to an anesthesia room, and the parents are with them until the child goes under. And then after surgery, the parents are brought in before the child comes out of anesthesia. So hospitals, hospitals have made some big advances. But there are just so many other things, and there are people called child life specialists in most major hospitals, and they go and meet with families and children before surgery to explain to them, you know, they'll have a gown for them to put on, they'll have the masks for them to wear. They even have a little pretend gas mask, you know, so they can pretend to breathe into that. They tell them about what the doctors are going to do. They give them coloring books. They come in afterwards and work with the kids. And it's very important if your child is going to have some kind of a surgery that you enlist the help of those child life specialists. And if your hospital doesn't have one, contact a bigger hospital, a university hospital, or a children's hospital, and ask to speak to their child life specialist and see what you can do. If a child has emergency surgery and the specialist can't meet with them beforehand, have them come in afterwards because they will do remediation therapy, you know, to help deal with some of the trauma. But another big thing parents need to do is watch their language. For example, instead of kids are very literal and they don't hear words like we do. So you might say somebody might say we're going to put him on a stretcher. And to a child, it would sound like the words stretch her. And they might get really scared. What do you mean they're going to stretch me, you know? Or even words like urine, they think are your in. So you have to explain all of those words to kids when they're in those situations. Just try and think, you know, what else could this mean? If I was a child, what would I have thought they were saying? Because kids will get really scared when they don't understand what they're hearing. And they can imagine really awful things. So try and be proactive and explain everything ahead of time and encourage them to ask you questions.
Good, good. That's some really great advice because I would have never thought about something like that.
I know, yeah.
And when you get in that, sometimes when you get in that emergency mode, something's happened, you're lucky to think the way to get to the hospital alone and thing else. So, you know.
Another really important thing for parents to do is allow their kids to control what they can control, but watch what questions you ask them. You don't say to them, well, are you ready to go to the hospital now? Because their answer is no, and you're going to have to say, well, you have to go anyway. So be honest with them and say, okay, you're going to have to go to the hospital, but do you want to take your red pajamas or your blue pajamas to wear after you have your surgery? You know, do you want to eat strawberry ice cream or vanilla ice cream after you have your tonsils out? So they feel like they have some control, but you aren't giving them false hope that they can opt out of the situation.
Right. Very good. Yes, and that kind of ties into my next thing that I wanted to touch on, and that's kids and fear. I know you speak about that in your book. Would you like to touch on that a little bit?
Again, it's much the same thing. Children are fearful of what they have never experienced. And as children, they haven't experienced very much. So you're going to have to explain to them as best you can what's going to happen so that they can not have fear. And you have to actively teach them what are some appropriate responses or appropriate ways to deal with their fear. Another thing I think you have to be aware of as parents, and this is something that when our son was born was very new, we ask over and over, are all of these procedures and is all this surgery going to affect him emotionally or mentally in any way? And we were told over and over, no, he'll be fine. He won't remember it. He's a baby. Mm-hmm. And now I don't think you will find very many doctors who will tell you that, because studies have shown that babies who are in neonatal intensive care or have severe medical trauma when they're young are much more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. And our son did, and he was not treated until this last year is when he was finally treated, and it totally turned his life around. And after the fourth day of his treatment, it was a week-long intensive one-on-one outpatient treatment, he turned to me and he said, "Mom, for the first time in 24 years, I'm not looking over my shoulder waiting for them to take me into surgery again."
Oh, that's heart.
Yes, and he is so, and this happened just as I was finishing up the manuscript of my book about a month before it was due. So I was able to go back with all that we had learned about post-traumatic stress caused by medical trauma, and I was able to do some revising in the book and add that into the book as something parents need to be watching for. And he is just adamant and says, "Mom, you have to get that message out. There shouldn't have to be any other kids that have to live like that." And, you know, maybe that's why I did, so that now we can go out and get the information out to people and more kids can not have to live with that kind of fear and anxiety.
Right, exactly. I know that the one part that I saw in the book that was so funny, because it just sounds like something I might do or know somebody that might do this, is the part about the landlord when you locked your keys in the car.
Yes.
And when I read that, you know, I'm emotional, I'm crying, and I'm reading, you know, through the book, and this bright little part pops up, and I think to mm-hmm. myself, I can see myself doing that mm-hmm. to help somebody out, and it just, I want you to share that, the quick story about that,
okay.
Because that was just so funny.
Yes, it was absolutely hilarious. When our son was in the hospital, the University of Nebraska at Omaha did not yet have a Ronald McDonald House. So for housing, they had several places that you could go and rent rooms. And so we were able to rent a room from a very elderly woman and her very sour, dour son a block or two away from the hospital. Well, one morning, we went outside and discovered that we had locked our keys in the car. And so we had to go back in, and we had to ask this gentleman, who never looked very pleased to see us, though he looked just like Tim Conway and sounded like Tim Conway. He did not have that man's sense of humor. We had to go in and tell him we didn't have the keys. Could he help us? So we took out, you know, a coat hanger and everything, and we're trying. We couldn't get it to work. We couldn't get anything to latch around the lock button, and we were all trying our hands into the fly window, which was open slightly, and trying to get our arms down and down there to open the lock, and we couldn't. And the elderly woman came out. She was very tiny, and she said, "You know, my arm's skinnier than anybody's. Let me put my arm in, and I'll try to get it." And she couldn't reach it. She pulled her arm out, and she said, "It's this darn shirt. It's blocking my way." And right there on a very busy intersection in Omaha, Iowa, she whipped off her shirt and stood there in her very dingy bra, reaching her arm in, trying to unlock the door. And her son was just standing on the grass, flapping his arms and running around in circles going, "Mom, put your shirt on, put your shirt on, Mom, put your shirt on, put your shirt on." And finally my husband was so embarrassed, he's like, "Please, put your shirt on." And eventually we got her back in her shirt, and she and her son are walking back to the house, and she's just going, "If you just would have let me try a little bit longer, I would have had it. I would have had it."
That is so cute.
It was, and it was just this, you know, it was, at first it was almost like, did that really happen? But for days and days, all we had to do while our son was still recovering was think about this lady and what she had done, and we would just start laughing, and that was so healing, and that's so important for parents. And so I tried to put a few of those different things, the really funny things that happened to us too, because it's the humor that keeps you going during a difficult situation like that.
Right, and that leads to my next one about laughter being so important. It just,
yes.
It's a release.
It is. It's a huge release. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, my father was also, he suffered from multiple sclerosis and was an invalid for 38 years and, you know, was taken down in the prime of his life. And he was a very funny guy. And when we grew up, he was wheelchair bound, couldn't work anymore. But we just thought my dad was the absolutely most hilarious person we'd ever met. And as we got older, you know, we would ask him, "Dad, how come you do that?" And he said, "Well, I can either laugh about this or I can cry about it, and I choose to laugh."
Wonderful, wonderful, yeah.
Yeah.
And laughter gets you out of some of the tightest spots, it seems like.
It really does, yeah. It just, again, it gives you that opportunity to kind of step back a minute and reevaluate, okay, you know, this is my situation to deal with, but there's still going to be a world here next week, and life's going to go on, and you know, there are going to be good times and there are going to be hard times, but I don't have to just be totally despondent about the situation I'm in right now.
Right, exactly. You also talk about in your book about there's no perfect child and no perfect result. Can you explain what you mean by that?
One of the things the doctors really were really adamant about when I talked with them was I would ask them, you know, how do you deal with the fact that parents look upon you because you hold their child's life in your hands? They look upon you almost as a god. You know, they put you on a pedestal at least, and they think you're going to have all the answers. And they were very adamant that we do not have the answers, and so often parents' expectations of what's going to happen are way beyond what is humanly possible. And they want parents to really be able to think realistically about what their child's prognosis or outcome will be. And one thing we learned was that when a doctor says, yes, this surgery will be successful, to them that means that they go in, they do what they're supposed to do, and the patient recovers. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the patient always recovers with full functioning. It means
right.
that the patient recovers. And so I think we have to realize that we have unrealistic, sometimes Disneyland, expectations of what a child's life is going to be like after an illness or a surgery. And we have to look at the situation and realize that even if it doesn't reach that point and life is not perfect, that child's life is still a good life and it has value. And we can be thankful for it. And the other thing is that when we think about the future, we only ever think of the good things that can happen. You know, we have this rosy picture of what's going to happen instead of a realistic picture of, you know, even if our child was normal or had no health issues, there are still things that can happen as your child grows up. You know, they can go through rough times. They can rebel. They can choose the wrong peer group. There are no guarantees. And even with that, we have to realize that if you're a Christian, you believe that, well, God is still in control and he can take this and he can bring good out of a difficult situation. And to me, as a Christian, that's one of the things that is most comforting. And if you're not, somehow you have to come to grips with that there, it can be not perfect, but even imperfect can still be good.
Right, exactly. I know that you speak in the book also about being your child's advocate.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times people may not know what that is or how to do that. Can you give us some tips and advice on that?
Sure. The first thing is you need to be balanced. Again, you have to realize that not everything might not be perfect, you know, and you can't go in expecting the impossible. But you do need to be your child's advocate. And if you're in the hospital with your child or you've received a diagnosis and a regime of treatment that's been recommended, you do have the right, and you probably should, in many cases, get a second opinion mm-hmm. and find out, you know, what, and start doing some research, find out what kind of treatments are out there, where the people are that can treat the illness the best, what is standard treatment and how does it play out. You need to be the person who finds that out. You're the child's parent. That's your job. You don't have to do it alone. Most hospitals mm-hmm. have a library where you can do research. Now that you can go online, you can Google things and find out all sorts of stuff. But then, and so you need to advocate and ask lots of questions. If your child's in the hospital being cared for and you think there's a problem with the care, you need to talk to the nurses. You need to talk to the doctors. I know we had to do that. There was one time when our son had had surgery and he was like 3 or 4, they put the IV in his foot after surgery. Well, he was going to have nothing to do with that foot. And he was drinking, he was getting all of his food through IV fluids. I think that was the mm-hmm. situation. And they weren't going to start him on solid food until he had, you know, which is the big thing you have to do in the hospital for all these things, until he'd had a bowel movement, or maybe he wasn't going to be released. I can't remember what it was. And I kept saying, but he's not going to have a bowel movement until he can get up and walk around, and he's not going to walk around as long as he has the IV in his foot. So we're right. stuck. We're stuck in this situation. And the nurses, of course, they aren't the ones that can do that. They can't remove an IV without doctor's orders. So when the doctor came in, I explained that to him, and he said, he went out right away and he just got the nurse and said, take out the IV. And when this mother talks to you about things, you listen to her. She knows what she's talking about. But the
Wonderful.
Flip side, yeah, the flip side of that is then that you have to prove to the hospital staff and to the doctors that you are responsible and you know what you're talking about. And you
right.
need to be kind to them. You need, mm-hmm. you can't ever speak to them, you know, go crazy, go ballistic, and expect
right.
that they're going to listen to what you have to say. You can't be accusing them all the time.
Right.
But you do yeah. have to be the one that is there for your child, because your child can't speak often
right.
for him or herself. You've got to be the one that does it. So and then after you've gotten all this information, and if you're hearing over and over the same information about treatment, at some point you have to say, okay, we're going to have to move forward, and we're going to choose this treatment. It's maybe not what I had hoped for, or, you know, I would want there to be more, but we've got to get started, and so let's get going and do this. You can't just keep hoping for something better and postpone what has to be done.
Right, exactly. Exactly, and if you don't stand up for your child, there may not be somebody else around that can, and Lord knows what would happen then.
Exactly, yeah. And even once you start a new treatment and are on a new course, you keep doing research, you know, and you keep looking for what the latest information is out about whatever your situation is, because, you know, you're the parent, and that's what you need to do.
Right, right, exactly. How important is community involvement with you reacting with you and your family and your needs and stuff
mm-hmm. it is
when times are like that?
Yeah, it is extremely important, and the longer the medical situation goes on, the more important that becomes. And unfortunately, our tendency is when a crisis first arises, the community rallies around and does lots, and then as it goes on and drags on for months and years, sometimes we kind of lag behind and forget to continue that kind of involvement. So if you are friends or extended family, you know, trying to support the family going through the difficulty, you need to be there long term, and you need to be very specific in what you offer to do. Because if you say to parents, dealing with an emergency situation or a crisis, what can I do to help? Call me if you need anything. They can't even think about what they need. You know, they're wrapped up in trying to deal with their child's health situation, and they're mm-hmm. getting all this information from doctors and nurses. They don't even remember what it's like to be back in their house. And so as friends and family, you need to be specific and just say, okay, I'm going to mow your lawn, or I'm going to scoop the snow. Or somebody else might say, if you're going to be not home for a while, I'll take your pets to my house, or I'll walk through and check your pipes every week and, you know, water the flowers. Or if there are siblings that are still at home, depending on the distances, maybe you would offer to have them come stay at your house for a while, or if you could move into their house so their lives didn't have to change so much, or do carpool, or even something like, okay, I will come up to the hospital once a week, and I'll bring you clean clothes, and you give me your dirty ones. I'll take them home and do your laundry and bring things back for you every week. So, and think of those things and commit to doing them as long as the situation goes on.
Right. Or just going up and sitting and giving somebody a break to actually out of the room and walk around. Even if you just walk around the courtyard at the hospital, just so they get out and get some fresh air and clear their mind.
Yes. Well, even think, I mean, you have to remember, too, these are kids that are in the hospital. And so if they're not deathly ill, you know, or they're on the mend, then maybe you need to be doing some fun stuff with the family, too. If the situation allows, maybe you could plan a movie night, you know, and bring popcorn. Or if it's around a holiday, you could bring up decorations and decorate the child's room. Or one of the fun things that a family did for us was, as Alan was recovering from his surgery, they brought a picnic. And so we all were able to go out in the courtyard. We put Alan in a little wagon, you know, and we just all went outside and had a wonderful picnic. And what a nice break that was.
Right, exactly, exactly. Well, I tell you, Jolene, we just love this book, and we're just so excited that you shared it with us and you were able to come today. Do you have any closing thoughts or tips that you want to share that maybe we didn't touch on?
Well, the book is available. I think it's starting to hit the Christian bookstores now, or any bookstores, actually. So if you want to get it through a bookstore, just call them and you could ask them to order it. You can also order it online at my website, differentdream.com, or from amazon.com. And I think if you just Google Different Dream for My Child, or then I think you'll find it that way. But Amazon definitely has it. And I would really invite any parents who are going through this kind of a situation to get onto my website, differentdream.com, and contact me, ask questions, read the blog entries that are there. I have a lot of other resources listed there that might help them, about specific illnesses, about books that would help them, anything like that. So I'd encourage them to get onto the website, differentdream.com, and if you know of anyone who is in this situation, I think the book is a great gift that you can give them to help them process what they're going through.
Exactly, exactly. And like I had mentioned, we are going to be donating this book. There's a children's hospital. I've been in touch with a couple pastors here in town that will be finding a family that could really benefit from this book, because I think it's just a godsend. This book is just wonderful.
Thank you.
I want to share it with somebody that needs it.
And I think that's the way the word is going to get out about it. You know, parents in a crisis aren't looking for a book. It's going to need to be somebody else that gives it to them, the pastors, their friends, their family, whoever, medical personnel, whoever.
Right, exactly, exactly. Well, Jolene, it has been my extreme pleasure to meet you, and thank you for sharing this hour with us and your book with us, and please come back anytime.
Thank you, Deb. I look forward to doing that. Hopefully there will be a follow-up book in the next couple years.
Oh, good, good. Well, we look forward to it.
You
have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, ladies, adifferentdream.com, and you can find her book. It's called A Different Dream for My Child, by Jolene Philo. That's her last name spelled P-H-I-L-O. Wonderful, wonderful book. Ladies, the next 2 days, we're off, and then we're going to be right back Monday, the 21st, with a regular show with Dorothy Ratzny. I hope I'm saying that name right. I do apologize if I'm not. Ladies, I want to take you out of the show today with a little music from Reba. I just love this song. Walk on. Nothing ever stays wrong that long. Walk on. Oh. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, ladies, we just thank you so much for joining us today. If you'd like to find out more about us, visit us online at powerwomenmagazine.com. We'd love to share our stories with you, and you share your stories with us, and that's what Power Women Magazine is about. We thank you so kindly. Be blessed, and we'll see you Monday. Bye-bye now.